This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. One of TV's all-time best writer-producers died last week at age 81. Larry Gelbart was most famous as the man who took the book and movie MASH and adapted it into a long-running hit CBS comedy about Army medical personnel during the Korean War. On Broadway, his credits include co-writing the deliriously funny Stephen Sondheim musical, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, and his movie screenplays include the popular Dustin Hoffman comedy, Tootsie. But Gelbart's entire resume, especially on television, was no less eclectic. More than any other writer, his work stretched out over many decades and types of television. In the 1990s, for HBO, he wrote the magnificently funny fact-based Barbarians at the Gate about the hostile corporate takeover of a tobacco company. In the 70s and 80s, he had MASH. And in the 50s, he wrote for Sid Caesar. Not for your show of shows, but for Caesar's subsequent variety series and specials, where he worked alongside such other budding comedy writers as Mel Brooks and Woody Allen. Here's a sample clip from that era, from Caesar's Hour. Sid Caesar plays a jazz musician, and Carl Reiner plays the pompous host of an equally pompous artsy anthology TV series. A jab at a show and a host on TV at the time, Omnibus with Alastair Cook.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The program is ominous. And I am your host, Aristotle Cookie. Tonight, we'd like to turn our ominous spotlight on music, more specifically the modern school of jazz. And to help enlighten us, we are proud to have with us this evening one of the foremost authorities in the new sounds in jazz. He has gone from the hot jazz to the cool jazz and now developed it into the frozen school of jazz. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Progress Hornsby. Mr. Hornsby. Good evening. Yes, well, good evening, Mr. Hornsby, and welcome to Ominous.
Hi, you cookie. Well, let's say we cut out the formalities and you just use the first four bars of my name. Progress.
Yes, well...
I think I'm floating around.
Yes, Progress, I understand that you use the name Progress as a... being symbolic of the way you feel about everything.
Man, I'm for moving ahead, constantly forward. If I have to back up my car, I sell it. Because going to the reverse is the worst, man, you know what I mean? Then you're really in danger of everything.
I must say, Progress, that your clothing is rather unusual.
Oh, you dig my dry goods, don't you, eh, man?
Yes.
It's a little thing I picked up in Rome.
Italy?
If that's where Rome is, then that's where I think.
I must say, Progress, like your music, it is a most unusual... It is a most unusual suit.
Oh, man, this is not the suit. This is just the underwear. My suit is out being fed. Would you like to move with me? I'm going somewhere.
Terry spoke with Larry Gelbart in 1996 and asked him about his days with Sid Caesar.
Now, what was it like writing for the Sid Caesar show as a group? Was it a collective process?
It was a totally collective process. We were all locked in the same room together every Monday morning from 10 o'clock until 6. On a Monday morning, we say, well, what do we do this Saturday night? And by Wednesday, we had written an hour show that would have been one or two or three or four sketches, perhaps a mime routine, perhaps some special musical material. And by Thursday, Sid was in the rehearsal hall with the performers rehearsing the material, and it was broadcast live, that is to say, in front of an audience, without laugh machines, without tape machines, without any, you know, mechanical help. By Saturday night at around 10 o'clock, it was all over. We had Sunday to relax and to either enjoy or regret what we had done on Saturday night. And then Monday it started all over again. But there we were all in the same room pitching jokes like crazy. Neil Simon captured it amazingly accurately and affectionately in a play he did a couple of years ago called Laughter on the 23rd Floor.
In an article in the New York Times a bunch of years ago, you described the writing room as supercharged, marvelously competitive, and literally violent. I'd like to hear about the violence.
Everybody wants to hear about the violence. A lot of the violence was directed at Mel Brooks. Mel, God bless him, I believe is the proper cliche at this moment, Mel is a vastly unique and talented man. He could not get to work on time. He was always late. And we resented it. And he knew we resented it, but it didn't stop him from being late. And so there were times when we would burn him in effigy.
Literally?
We would have a hat, a shirt, a jacket or something of him, set fire to it in this office building in New York City on 57th Street. We would throw – Mel once wrapped me on the bottom of my feet with a ruler. I was sitting up with my feet up on the desk, and for some reason he just smacked me across the bottom. So they really hurt. And so when I – first chance I could get, I threw his shoes out the window. He had taken them off because he was napping or something. And so he had to go downstairs barefoot and buy a new pair of shoes. There was an awful lot of ambivalence in the room, and the negative side of it often resulted in that kind of violence, although not continuously. And we didn't even have time for that kind of nonsense, truly. But we took a moment or two to vent our collective spleens.
I imagine there was a lot of ego and a lot of neurosis in the room.
Probably more neurosis than ego, because when you're in what amounts to a dugout of writers, a battery of writers, you're punching away. You don't smart because one joke, wasn't accepted by the others. You come up with another one. When there's a good one, fine. That then you're one joke closer to having a sketch written, say. So while we all had healthy egos, what was the other? What was the
neurosis?
Neurosis. Oh, that we were. We were all very neurotic. Very neurotic. I like to think we all still are. But no one more neurotic than Sid. I mean,
How did Sid Caesar's neurosis get expressed, and how did you deal with it?
Well, Sid was really kind of, walking around encased in rage for a lot of years. I mean, he's talked about his own demons, his substance abuse and stuff. I don't want to elaborate on that, but Sid was a mess, and there were times he would come to the office wearing carrying a revolver.
You're kidding?
A Magnum revolver, yeah.
Like loaded?
He was, and the gun was too. No, Sid did not drink until after 6 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
So we all used to try to get out of there about 5 minutes to 6. But Sid had a lot of anger. And Sid was like a refrigerator in a sports jacket. He was a big, big man. Sid was Mel Brooks used the joke in Blazing Saddles, but once Sid was horseback riding in Central Park with his wife Florence, and Florence's horse threw Florence to the ground, and Sid got off his horse and punched Florence's horse right between the eyes, and the horse went down. I mean, we're talking about that kind of strength and violence that was set to go off in any second.
So when he would bring his gun to work, would he brandish it at the at the writers? What would he? What
oh
would
no
he
no
do
no
then?
He. Sid, there was a time there for a while.
Oh, I know what he'd do. He'd hold the gun to his forehead and say, "Oh," he'd hold out the gun and he'd say, "That those jokes stink. If you want to kill me, use this."
No, he didn't. No, there was a time. Sid went through a paranoid stage where he thought that Otto Skorzeny, the famous Nazi provocateur, was after him.
Oh,
so
gosh.
He was really carrying it in self-defense. Now it becomes understandable, I hope.
Right, that he was having paranoid delusions.
Yeah, that the man was going to surface in a submarine in the East River and come over to 57th Street and get Sid. Sid felt no violence towards us. He really did then and still does have a healthy respect for what we did with and for him.
Well, let me ask you, if he thought that someone was out to get him, who clearly wasn't, did you ever worry about how he was going to perform live on television?
No. Sid, we never worried for one second. The only thing we knew that Sid would not be sure of was being able to say good evening to the audience as Sid Caesar. Once he got into any sketch any prepared material, once he could do a monologue, once he could do a mime, once he could play a character, he was fine. The only person in the world he did not know how to play was Sid Caesar. He had a neurotic, persistent hack. He would cough. It would be good evening, ladies. He could not say good evening, ladies and gentlemen. That's what we worried about. We thought that would be the whole hour, Sid saying good evening.
So would you have him say good evening in somebody else's character just to get him through that?
No, he had to be himself for a second.
Right.
Sid was often not himself when he was off camera. I mean, we talk about it in that session that we had when we got together. We talk about the fact that for almost a year, Sid spoke with a Polish accent. He yes, he pretended to be a Polish janitor, a maintenance man, and that's the way he can. That's the way he said good morning. That's the way he had lunch with you, and that's the way he said good night.
Larry Gelbart speaking to Terry Gross in 1996. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1996 interview with Larry Gelbart, who died last week at age 81. Gelbart was on Sid Caesar's writing staff and developed MASH into a hit TV show. He also co-wrote the book for the Broadway musical, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
Larry Gelbart, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum is based on the plays of the Roman writer Plautus, who was born in 254 B.C. So this guy wrote a long, long time ago. What's the connection between Plautus and Forum?
Total. We read the 26 plays of his, which still exist, 27 plays of his, which are extant, and we selected a character here, a character there, a bit of a storyline here, and another one from another play, and then started adding our own connective tissue and our own Plautine-like complications. So it's a direct line from work that is over 2,000 years old to what they're doing on Broadway today. There is one line in the play which was done in 200 B.C., where Miles Gloriosus, the braggart warrior, says to his admirers, he says, "I am a parade." And it always gets a laugh. Steve worked it into a lyric. And that line, as I said, is about 2,500 years old.
Was Plautus the Roman father of low comedy?
He was the Roman father of low comedy. I got in trouble writing a piece recently for the New York Times in which I said he invented it all. The truth is he adapted a great deal of it from the Greeks, from Menander and others. But he was certainly one of the first people to introduce comic conventions. One would think comedy was always with us, and in fact it has always been with us, but these were people who organized that comedy. They gave us stereotypes. They gave us the henpecked husband. They gave us the moonstruck young lover. They gave us the wily slave, the henpecked husband, and the braggart warrior, and situations, mistaken identities, all sorts of comic conventions which have not been changed or improved upon in two millennia.
You were the principal writer for MASH from 1972 to 1976. You're the guy who developed it from the film. Did it seem to you when you were starting on MASH that a mobile surgical unit in the Korean War was the perfect subject for a TV sitcom?
No. I think it was the perfect setting for a television half hour. I don't think that MASH... I never have thought of it
as a sitcom.
Mm-hmm. Truly. Mm-hmm. Because of what sitcom has come to mean, you know, the Hello, Honey, I'm Home kind of show.
Laugh.
Three-camera tape, studio show. In a funny way, Forum is more of a sitcom than MASH is, because all the laughs in that show are situational. They all derive from situation. No, I just thought that MASH, as a weekly show, could address an area of human behavior that would lend itself to comedy and more, a comedy in a minor key, much as the theme song.
Of Suicide is Painless.
Yeah. But yes, I did think it was going to be something I would enjoy writing.
Do you have a favorite episode?
I think my favorite episode is the least written episode, and that was the one that was sort of my valedictory episode. It was the last episode of the fourth year, and it was called The Interview, and it's in black and white. And it consists of a series of interviews with the actors in character talking about the war, how they feel about it. And I think it was rather a remarkable document, if I can be so modest. I can be so modest because a lot of it was improvised. A lot of what the actor said was not written for them. They came up with it themselves.
You've written a lot of drag humor over the years. You co-wrote Tootsie.
Yes.
Of course, Klinger was in drag during a lot of MASH.
Yes.
And there's some drag humor in Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
You can see how far drag humor goes. That was taken from, you know, the convention that began
in ancient Rome.
Day. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you mean, what's the attraction for me?
Well, so what's so funny about? We've all, laughed, but analytically, which I figured you might analyze this as a writer. Analytically, what's so funny about a man in a dress, particularly if it's like a straight man in a dress?
I don't know. I'm sitting in front of a mirror now in the dress, and I don't think it's very funny. I think it's very attractive. what's funny is it just knocks the props out of any kind of ridiculous masculine ego. It just lets us be, because it's just such a reversal of what we think we are and what we hope to come off as. I mean, that's not a very scholarly response, but I think that's going to have to do.
Your family moved to Hollywood when you were a kid, and
yes.
Your father was a barber.
My father has the rare distinction of having been a barber to both JFK and Harry Ruby.
Wow. Harry Ruby, the songwriter Harry Ruby?
No, Harry Ruby. Jack Ruby, excuse me.
Oh.
Jack Ruby. And his son has the rare distinction of having Alzheimer's before his father. No, Jack Ruby, who of course shot Lee Harvey Oswald.
Wow. Well, okay. When the family moved to Hollywood, your father started cutting the heads of movie stars like Edward G. Robinson, Gregory Peck, George Raft. How did he become barber to the stars?
Well, we were in living in L.A. in Hollywood, and it just happened that the shop where he finally was able to practice his trade was heavily populated with named people. It was called Drucker's Barbershop in Beverly Hills, above a very exclusive men's haberdashery called Jerry Rothschild's. And all these people came in there, all of them from from the stars to other stars, to gangster stars, Bugsy Siegel, Mickey Cohn, people like that, and presidents.
The story of your father cutting the hair of celebrities, I think, segues perfectly into the story of how you became a professional comedy writer. So let me let you tell the story.
Well, one of my father's clients was Danny Thomas. We are now, of course, talking about 45, 46? No, before that, 43. And he told Thomas that Thomas was appearing on a radio show called the Fanny Bryce Maxwell House Coffee Time. My dad, quite on his own bat, because I had never, ever, ever thought of writing as a living or even something I could do, writing comedy. I was the typical sort of high school show-off who put on plays, and whether it was in the auditorium or in the geography or history class, I was always cutting up, mostly to cover up the fact that I had not done my work. But anyway, he said to Thomas, "My son is very clever. Would you like to have him write something for you?" And Thomas said, "Sure." I mean, what did it cost him, And so I wrote some material for him, and Thomas was impressed enough to pass me along to the head writer of a show, a man named Mac Benoff. Then Mac put me to work on the staff. I was 16.
Do you remember anything you wrote for him?
I remember a joke. Because I remember standing in the control booth again and hearing it read by an actor at a microphone and having an audience laugh. And that was the first time that ever happened to me. I don't know what the buildup was. Someone who was being charged with some heinous crime and the punchline the man at whom these charges were directed, said, "I said I was sorry." I mean, I know that doesn't sound funny now. But that was the joke. Look at that. It's still getting a laugh. I feel like Plautus. And that was the joke. And I remember, you know, all these years that was my first taste of this kind of reaction.
Larry Gelbart, speaking to Terry Gross in 1996. He died last week at age 81. The finale of MASH, the series which he developed for television, drew an audience rating that has never been equaled by a regularly scheduled television program, and probably never will. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Stephen Sondheim's opening song to A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Comedy Tonight.
Something familiar, something peculiar, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Something appealing, something appalling, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Nothing with kings, nothing with crowns. Bring on the lovers, liars, and clowns. Old situations, new complications, nothing portentous or polite. Tragedy tomorrow, comedy tonight.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. The Beatles are hardly obscure, and the release last week of their entire catalog of recordings in new remasterings, as well as the Beatles Rock Band game, has thrust them into the news again. Sales numbers from the first week are now in. News of 626,000 albums sold. And those box sets, by the way, they're counted as one unit. Our rock historian, Ed Ward, has spent the past couple of decades without a single Beatles record in his house, but has used the occasion of the re-release to listen to them all again.
Just let me hear some of that rock and roll music. Any old way you choose it. It's got a backbeat, you can't lose it. Any old time you use it. Gotta be rock and roll music. If you wanna dance with me. If you wanna dance with me. I got no kick against modern jazz.
My relationship with the Beatles has always been sort of tense. When they first appeared on the scene, I'd already been through my rock and roll period and rejected it when all the plastic Bobbies and Fabians began to appear. Instead, I'd turned to folk music, which was more real, more important, and more grown up. I had, after all, just turned 15. And there was another thing. My sister, who was 3.5 years younger than me, loved the Beatles. No 15-year-old boy is ever going to share the taste of an 11-year-old girl, for heaven's sakes. But a couple of years later, I went to college and was beginning to change my mind. A friend's brother said he had a protest song he wanted me to hear and played me Satisfaction. A number of my folk idols were plugging in, as I'd already seen Bob Dylan do at Forest Hills Tennis Stadium. So when the Beatles came out with Rubber Soul, I felt they'd met me halfway.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere.
And hey, they were writing protest songs too. So, realizing that folk and rock could coexist peacefully in my life, I continued with both. But unlike with the Rolling Stones, I never went backwards into the Beatles catalog and never paid it much attention. I was far more interested in the innovations they were coming up with, which always seemed to be just in advance of the rest of the world catching on. Like everyone else, I celebrated Sgt. Pepper and wondered about Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane. But suddenly, there were so many interesting groups that the Beatles just became one of them. For me, this changed in 1969. I'd been writing for a new magazine called Rolling Stone, and they asked me to review the new Beatles album, which was a real honor. They didn't even know its name, but within a few days, I did. In a move that's inconceivable now, Capitol Records sent me a copy of Abbey Road 3 weeks before it was going to be released, so I could listen to it and write about it, which I did. The thing was, though, I didn't like it. Surely, I wrote, they must have enough talent and intelligence to do better than this. And so Rolling Stone, which could have scooped the world, held on to the review until someone could be found to write a very positive one. I don't even think I listened to Let It Be when it came out, and then the Beatles were history. And so my record collection, and then my CD collection, was Beatle deficient until just recently. When the remasters were announced, I decided this was my opportunity to rehear the Beatles in their totality, from their first recording session to their last. And if the mastering job was as good as it should be, maybe I'd actually hear them for the first time. American pressings were notoriously bad, and I could never afford the British ones.
Here I stand, head in hand, turn my face to the wall. If she's gone, I can't go on, feeling 2 foot small. Everywhere people stare, each and every day. I can see them laugh at me, and I hear them say, hey, you've got to hide your love away. Hey, you've got to hide your love away.
The first good thing about the remasters is they follow the British releases. American publishing fees limited the number of songs on an album, so until Sgt. Pepper, all the Beatles albums were missing tracks. This meant that odd compilations were released from time to time, albums made up of tracks from here and there. So Beatles for Sale and the original Help album are far more coherent artistic statements than their American equivalents, Beatles 65 and the American Help soundtrack. The curve of the band's development was suddenly clearer to me, and Rubber Soul didn't seem like such a radical move in context. It was a natural musical progression, and somewhere along the way, they learned to write decent lyrics. The second good thing about the remasters, of course, is the remastering. Meet the Beatles, warts and all. Not only do the chiming guitars chime brilliantly, and Ringo's drums go off like bombs, but the occasional mistake shines through, and the really bad stuff, like the White Album's Revolution 9, is there for all to hear, the Emperor standing naked. But there isn't much really bad stuff, although the White Album could use a good edit down to one disc, and the new sound quality seems to me to be the best these recordings have ever sounded, and that's without hearing the mono mixes, which in some cases are probably even better. And the third good thing, of course, is that it's all here. A double disc called Past Masters collects all the stuff that wasn't on albums, from the early singles to the utterly redundant B-side You Know My Name, Look Up the Number. The black box is like a coffin, or maybe an archive box, which closes with a satisfying magnetic clunk. Here are the Beatles, it says. Make of them what you will. Millions have, and millions will. I finally got to hear it all, and I have to say, I like them better than ever.
Ed Ward lives in the south of France. Last night, Amy Poehler scored a rare primetime TV doubleheader. She guest starred on the season premiere of NBC's Saturday Night Live Weekend Update Thursday, anchoring the fake news with Seth Meyers. And then, immediately after that, she starred in the second season premiere of her own NBC sitcom, Parks and Recreation. She plays Leslie Knope, the deputy parks director in the fictional town of Pawnee, Indiana. Amy Poehler was a regular cast member of Saturday Night Live from 2001 to 2008. In her final year at SNL, she received a lot of attention for co-anchoring Weekend Update, her portrayal of Hillary Clinton during an election year, her Sarah Palin rap, and her increasingly evident pregnancy. Terry spoke with Amy Poehler in May. Here's a clip from last night's show. Poehler, as Leslie, imported a pair of penguins to be married in a special ceremony at the local zoo. Except she mistakenly selected two penguins who were male. An angry constituent comes to complain.
Well, what can I do for you and those fine people at the SFSF?
Well, you could resign if you're up for it.
Oh, you're serious?
When you performed a marriage for gay penguins, using taxpayer money on government property, you were symbolically taking a stand in favor of the gay marriage agenda.
Oh, I'm sorry, but hold on a second there, Marcia. That was not my intention at all.
Well, why else would you marry penguins?
Because I firmly believed that it would be cute. And it was.
Leslie, are you married?
No, not yet, Marcia. Soon, probably. I have a plan. But no, not now. Not dating anyone yet. Focusing on my career. But...
I thought so. So you couldn't possibly understand. But when gays marry, it ruins marriage for the rest of us. So either you annul the wedding, or I'll publicly ask for your resignation. You know what? I'm so terrible with directions. If I'm headed to the parking lot, do I make a left out of here or do I go
right?
It's
a left, yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Annul the wedding.
Amy Poehler, welcome to Fresh Air. It's great to have you here. Let me ask you to describe your character on Parks and Recreation.
Well, Leslie Knope is a misguided optimist. She's kind of a person in local government who believes that things can happen really fast and big changes should happen. So she's kind of, I'll refer to her often as an open-faced sandwich. She's very easy to read and a little sloppy. She's a, I really like playing her because she's, she overpromises, but she's also very kind of well-intentioned and there's nothing cool about her.
One of the things I like about the character is that her ambitions are so small. Like when she gets her own subcommittee, it's like she's been elected president of the United States.
Right. Well, Leslie has a life plan. And, you know, when she explains it, it's over very small little increments. And, you know, she talks about how her next step is getting on the city council and then, you know, becoming perhaps a, you know, the right-hand man of the lieutenant governor of Indiana. And then that governor dies and then she takes over. And then, you know, after a scandal, she runs for senator. And it's just a very slow process for Leslie. And so these small little victories are low stakes but high excitement for her.
Parks and Recreation was created by Greg Daniels, who also created the American version of The Office. And there are similarities between the two shows. They're kind of companions, one set in a paper office and the other in a small town government office. But they're both in that mockumentary style. Have you watched The Office a lot? And on the whole, is it better to have seen or not seen much of The Office?
Ever since I knew that I was doing this show, I stopped watching The Office, which was hard to do because I love that show and the performers on it. But I had to stop because, well, it's hard to enjoy comedy in general right now when you're on. It's very hard to watch comedy when I'm doing a comedy show because I either watch a show and I love it and I'm jealous, or I watch a show and I see all the problems with it and I'm angry that I watched it. But that's for my shrink, not for you, Terry. I was a huge fan, and then I had to stop just because it's kind of too weird to kind of watch it at the same time.
So, do you miss Saturday Night Live?
I do. I mean, I think it's kind of the most exciting job I will ever have in many ways, and I certainly miss that exhilarating pace of it. But the opportunity to kind of stay in one place and play, you know, a character that grows and changes is really exciting as an actor. And SNL, there's this very, you know, it's a machine. And when you jump off the train and it speeds away and you kind of get the dust in your face and you cough and you wave goodbye to your friends and you think, oh, no, you know, there it goes. What a ride while I was on it, but I might need to... You know, I might need to walk by the side of the tracks for a while. but I do. I do. I miss it a lot. And the people that work there are tremendous at their jobs. And so, yeah, I do.
Now, how did you get the part of doing Hillary during the primary?
Well, I think I started doing her in like 2004, 2005. I tried to do her a couple of times. And certainly, it probably was just I was... it was a process of, you know, sometimes when you're doing an impression on that show, it's just kind of because you maybe have a take on that person or you sound or look like that person. I think that I probably got the job because everyone else just wasn't paying attention that week because I certainly don't sound like her. We were similar, but in the way we look, but I didn't really have a take on her. So it took a while to figure out how to play her.
One of the sketches you did as Hillary Clinton was a debate sketch in which Obama was depicted as someone who the media really pampered and catered to. And as Hillary, you pointed that out. And then Hillary Clinton, the real Hillary Clinton, took that and ran with it, mm-hmm. basically quoted it in her stump speeches and said, look, you know, this is what Saturday Night Live is saying. And then she shortly after that appeared on Saturday Night Live in what was called like an editorial response. She basically said, I was told not to be flattered by this and that this is not an endorsement of me. Mm-hmm. And let me play the sketch that ensued after that when you and she were together on stage.
I still enjoyed that sketch a great deal because I simply adore Amy's impression of me.
Oh, well, my ears are ringing.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, well, thank you for coming. I love your outfit.
Well, I love your outfit.
Why,
but I
thank you.
Do want the earrings back.
Oh, okay.
Do I really laugh like that?
Well. So, how's the campaign going?
Oh, the campaign is going very well. Very, very well.
Great.
Why? What have you heard?
Nothing.
Oh.
It's Hillary Clinton with my guest Amy Poehler on a sketch on Saturday Night Live. So what was it like to be on stage with Hillary? And I should mention you were, you know, dressed identically in brown tweed jackets with black piping.
Much kudos to our wardrobe department who makes those jackets in about 45 minutes. These people are geniuses at what they do. And, you know, you'll get a call, you know, so-and-so, you know, someone's going to play Donald Trump and he has to be a vampire and this has to happen in 20 minutes. And like any live show, the people are so great because there's no – it's like an emergency room. There's no one stands in the middle of the room and starts screaming, we're never going to do this. This is never going to work. It'll never happen. We don't have enough time. It's just okay. Everyone says okay, and it gets done over and over again in the best way. But sorry, I forgot your question.
Oh, what was it like to be on stage with Hillary Clinton?
Well, it's always strange to be dressed like someone and stand next to them. That's always strange, unless you're, you know, a twin and your parents, your mother dressed you for the day. But so it was. It was exhilarating. It was fun.
Can I point out, not everything that you did about her was flattering. So was that awkward? Making fun of her laugh, which you did on stage with her, mm-hmm. did you feel like, okay, I've said some things and done some things that are probably a little offensive to her, and here we are together?
Yeah, that certainly happens. You know, there would be times when I heard that her camp were excited about something they saw, and I would say, "Oh, be careful, because you might not be excited this week." You know? Oh boy, you certainly have that moment where you're like, "Oh boy, sorry about that," but or not sorry about that, you know, depending on what you do. But it's interesting that you point out the laugh, just because that I think is an example of she doesn't really laugh like that, but the perception of her laugh was interesting, that people believed that she laughed like that. She didn't. She actually has a kind of like a very inclusive and open laugh, and it's kind of warm. But that laugh came from her trying to keep things down and kind of not being able to believe all the stuff that she had to deal with. And so that's how that laugh came to be. But it really isn't anything like the way she laughs. And so it's kind of interesting to... because I don't really do a very good impression of her, so it was kind of an impression of the impression of her that was seemed to be working or seemed to be getting laughs.
Amy Poehler speaking with Terry Gross in May. Poehler's NBC comedy series, Parks and Recreation, began its second season last night. New Zealand-born writer and director Jane Campion is best known for her 1993 drama, The Piano. Her new film is Bright Star, named after a poem by John Keats. The Australian actress Abby Cornish plays Fanny Braun, the object of Keats's affection, and the woman for whom he wrote that poem. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Having seen many BBC literary biopics, I've come to think of the romantic poets as lyrical fops lolling on verdant lawns, their musings interrupted by bronchial spasms directed into tastefully blood-spotted handkerchiefs. Jane Campion's Bright Star is in a different league. Set in the 19th century, the movie centers on the unconsummated affair of John Keats and his Hampstead neighbor, Fanny Braun, and it has a palette and rhythm all its own. Campion tells the story in brief yet tortured scenes, her texture rough, abrasive. Every quick exchange suggests violence, emotional violence, but with physical consequences, as if blood could truly be poisoned by lovesickness and a heart could literally break. The film is that vivid. Abby Cornish plays Fanny, a flirty young woman who sews her own clothes, flouncy things, with ruffles, and is instantly smitten with Ben Whishaw's Keats. The poet is wan and impoverished, unappreciated by critics, and stricken over the wasting away of his younger brother from TB. He can barely give Fanny his full attention, even when she asks him to tutor her in poetry. The movie has a third major force, Keats's friend Charles Armitage Brown, played to the unnerving hilt by Paul Schneider. He hates Fanny and openly mocks her. He says he wants to keep the fragile Keats pure, ever primed for the visit of the muse. But his behavior suggests an abandoned lover. Bright Star is as near as Campion has come to what Keats dubbed negative capability, which he describes in this movie as when a person is capable of, quote, being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. What I mean in regard to Campion is that she abandons her usual arty mannerisms and agenda, which is to dramatize the ways in which women are punished by a patriarchal society for wanting to control their own bodies. Here, both Fanny and Keats suffer at the hands of a culture that leaves the penniless poet too bereft and ashamed to make the bond with his true love a formal one. That said, Campion does have a modest feminist agenda to salvage Braun's 19th-century reputation as a loose woman who overtaxed the energies of her brilliant lover and had the tastelessness to publish his demonstrative letters after his death when his reputation soared. The movie leaves no doubt that the world is better for those sublime letters, snatches of which we hear. And Campion dramatizes how deeply Braun longed to enter Keats's inner world.
I had such a dream last night. I was floating above the trees, with my lips connected to those of a beautiful figure. For what seemed like an age, flowery treetops sprang up beneath us, and we rested on them with the lightness of a cloud.
Who was the figure?
I must have had my eyes closed because I can't remember.
And yet you remember the treetops?
Not so well as I remember the lips.
Whose lips? Were they my lips?
The emotions in Bright Star are never tidy. Abby Cornish struggles to maintain her poise in a way that's most un-Keira Knightley-ish, and she's a touching mess lying on her bed on yet another day with no letter from Keats.
No letter.
Not today.
My love. This love
She'll never tease about it again.
The movie doesn't have a single less-than-perfect performance. I especially loved little Edie Martin with her swarm of red ringlets as Fanny's sister Toots. She has a luminous deadpan. The one-off note? The closing credits, over which Wishaw reads the poem Bright Star in pear-shaped BBC syllables, too refined given what we've lived through. It's beautiful but embalmed, while the film is unruly and alive.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.